another party. In fact, they often try to deal with it themselves, and they are less likely to tell their friend or family member because they're much more embarrassed.
It's not just got to do with the income and the education, but really a lot has got to do also with the beliefs that we hold.
Shame, embarrassment, saving the family honor.
Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that when I think about drawing attention to my problems, I draw attention to not just shaming me as a person, but shaming my family, my community.
But if victims remain silent, do family and friends have the responsibility to speak out? That is Robert's dilemma. He has known Luke and Lena for 30 years.
I actually did not believe that he would do such a thing. So when she told me about it, she said, I don't think I want to be with him. So I told her, well, give yourself a bit of time, think about it.
Robert never imagined that his friend could be a wife beater.
We always tell him, if you've got a good wife, then just, control yourself. Oh no, I love my wife. I love my wife very much. I will not do such a thing. But we can see, a few times when myself and my spouse met this couple, we could see on her face black and blue marks hidden under the makeup.
When Robert accepted that his friend Luke was an abusive husband, he offered help.
I tried to help her by asking her if she needs any, advice from lawyers, if she needs to get away from him. We could help her find a place.
But fear has kept Lena under her own roof.
If she were to leave him, she thinks that she will lose whatever she's put into the home. And she may lose her son also.
Family violence professionals believe that the community has a larger role to play.
Violence will only stop if the society actually is more proactive, because it is really the people around the victim that have much more choices than the victim, much more choices to do something about the problem.
For most people, the hardest part is knowing when to take action and how far to go.
I have this fear factor in me that what happens in their home behind closed doors is very private. And the fear is, if I were to actually interfere in their private affairs, it may backfire. So either party has to make the first step.
Without an explicit cry for help, Robert feels he cannot act further.
If she comes to me physically and says, look, this is what has happened to me, with all the bruises and all the black and blue marks on her face or arms, I would personally think that I will bring her to a police station to make a report. But she has never at one time said, yes, help me, or I will follow your advice. So I'm in a very difficult position to report this matter to the authorities.
When is the right time to act?
There's something called the battered wife syndrome, and there are people who have been in victim mentality for many, many years, right? And the children see it, right? But are powerless, right? And so I think in some cases, you actually need to allow people like their children or even social workers to help them take that first step and to initiate the process, because otherwise they will continue to be in this situation.
Now that her son is about close to 30 years old, he's still single, she did bring this subject up to him and ask him that, she told him that one of these days I'm going to walk out of the house. I hope you will not blame me and you will support me. His answer to her regret was, this is a problem between you and dad. Don't get me involved. It really broke her heart. And She said all this while she's been living in the home for the son, yeah. And now with him saying this few words to her, she was really very disappointed.
So what do you think were Shuwei's beliefs though?
At workshops run by advocacy groups like AWARE, gender stereotypes are being questioned.
You should be submissive.
I accept.
You should be a housewife.
You should be able to cook.
It's your job to look after the children.
You should keep the family together.
I accept.
Brave now.
I accept.
Macho.
You shouldn't cry.
I accept.
You're always right.
Whoa. I accept.
You are a role model.
I accept.
Without a shift in societal attitudes, responses to domestic abuse remain unchanged.
There are three typical responses when a person is confronted with domestic violence. One is to deny that it exists. Turn the other way. Don't deal with it. The other is to acknowledge it exists, but to minimize it. To say that this is a once-off thing. To say that it only affects the poorer community, the less educated, the migrants. And when these two initial responses isn't adequate, the third response is always to blame the victim.
Hearts, minds, attitudes. These are the keys to shaping a better future.
So you can do case management till the cows come home. Every case, you empower the woman, you give her all her options, and then she finds a solution, right? But it just keeps happening. So until you try to change, until you change the societal attitudes, it's going to continue, and you're just going to have cases continue all the time. Yeah, so we really have to, even though it's long term, it might take 10 years, even more, but we have to start somewhere. So this is the driving force behind the weekend campaign. It's the first time that we're actually doing a campaign that lasts more than a year, but we think this is necessary, right? So we plan for at least a three-year campaign, and we say, if it has to be a community effort, right? So we are really just a catalyst. We provide the tools, and we try to inspire people to think about the problem and how they themselves can be part of the solution.
I would like to encourage others to not submit to other people's expectations of you.
My change is to remind people of their freedom of choice and their right to choose.
My change is to start believing in myself well. Then I think I can help others believe in themselves as well.
Mine was not a physical abusive relationship, but it was more mental and psychological that slowly deteriorated my sense of self-worth over that 24 period time frame. So I think that what, as a woman, I would like to do is reclaim my sense of self-worth and then teach my daughters what it means to be a powerful woman.
When I share my story, you know, people will say things like, what did you do? Did you do something to make him behave that way, you know? There's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know. And the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know. But I'm very fortunate in a way that my children are very supportive of what I do. They are very proud of the work I do, you know. The more I see this, the more I feel that, you know, I should share that there's really nothing wrong in facing our demons, you know, straight on.
Mira, too, is no longer a victim.
Every day for the rest of my life, when I look into the mirror, I'm going to see that scar. But it's a scar that will tell me that I tried. I tried really hard. I got into a relationship eyes wide open with hope. However, I used to look at it and cry. Not anymore. I look at it and I feel brave about it and I tell myself I survived. I survived because of very strong family support, really good strong friends who made sure that I was going to be strong, accepted me, allowed me to cry. I came out of a toxic marriage. Today, if I see a woman get beat up by a man, I will go and help the woman. I don't care how big that guy is going to be. I don't care if that guy is going to use vulgarities on me, but I would go rescue that woman.
Today, Rachel proudly stands her ground and openly tells her story so that other women don't have to face the same ordeal alone.
Is there any other point
you always feel that, you know, why is this happening to me, you know, especially when you look around and, you know, people are having happy marriages, happy families, you know. And you will feel like, you know, you're so alone in the world, you know, that it's only happening to you. And that's the reason why I'm speaking out about this, you know, so that other women will know that it is not only just happening to them.
Perhaps breaking the suffocating silence is the first step in ending the issue of domestic violence and abuse. Women enduring such horrific conditions must find the courage and strength to speak out and seek help. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Not a single day passes without a Palestinian tree or an orchard being set ablaze or cut down. Clearing the Palestinian environment is, and has always been, the prerequisite of constructing or expanding Jewish settlements. For these colonies to be built, countless trees have to be removed, along with the Palestinians who have planted them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ramzi Barut, journalist. This article is titled, How the Israeli Regime Occupation Ravages the Environment in Palestine. Stay tuned for more. Those who are not familiar with how the Zionist regime, particularly the Zionist regime military occupation of Palestine, is actively and irreversibly damaging the environment, might reach the erroneous conclusion that Tel Aviv is at the forefront of the global fight against climate change. The reality is the exact opposite. In his speech at the UN Climate Change Conference, COP26 in Glasgow, the Zionist regime's right-wing Prime Minister Naftali Bennett pushed the Israeli brand of innovation and ingenuity to promote clean energy and reduce greenhouse gases. The Zionist regime uses this particular brand to sell everything, whether to promote itself as the savior of Africa, to help governments intercept fleeing refugees, to push deadly weapons in the global market, or as Bennett has done in Scotland, supposedly save the environment. Just before we hastily dismiss Bennett's rhetoric as empty words, we must remember that some are actually buying into this Israeli regime propaganda, one of whom is the American billionaire Bill Gates. The day following Bennett's speech, Gates met with the Zionist regime prime minister on the sidelines of COP26 to discuss the establishment of a working group to study potential cooperation between the Zionist regime and Gates Foundation in the area of climate change innovation, the Times of Israel newspaper reported recently. According to the newspaper, Gates, who had asserted in his meeting with Bennett that only innovation can solve the problem of climate change, said that's really what Israel is known for. Gates' obsession with innovation, however, might have blinded him from addressing other issues that the Zionist regime is also known for, namely being the world's leading human rights violator, whose horrific track of record of racial apartheid and violence is known to every member of the United Nations. However, there is something else that Gates might also not be aware of. The systematic and purposeful destruction of the Palestinian environment, resulting from the Israeli regime occupation of Palestine and Tel Aviv's insatiable appetite for military superiority, thus constant innovation. Every act that is carried out to entrench the military occupation consolidates the Israeli regime's colonial control, and expanding illegal Jewish settlements directly impacts the Palestinian environment. Not a single day passes without a Palestinian tree or an orchard being set ablaze or cut down. Clearing the Palestinian environment is, and has always been, the prerequisite of constructing or expanding Jewish settlements. For these colonies to be built, countless trees have to be removed, along with the Palestinians who have planted them. Over the years, millions of Palestinian olive and fruit-bearing trees were uprooted in the Zionist regime's constant hunger for more land. The soil erosion in many parts of occupied Palestine speaks volumes of this horrendous ecocide. But it does not end here, of course. For hundreds of illegal Jewish settlements hosting a population of more than 600,000 settlers to survive, a heavy price is being exacted from the Palestinian environment on a daily basis. According to the thorough research of Ahmad Aboufu, an independent legal researcher with Al-Haq Rights Group, illegal Israeli settlements generate around 145,000 tons of domestic waste daily. Aboufu reported that in 2016 alone, around 83 million cubic meters of wastewater were pumped throughout the West Bank. Moreover, the Zionist regime has near total control of Palestinian water resources. It relies on the occupied West Bank's aquifers to supplant its need for water while denying Palestinians access to their own water. According to Amnesty International, the average Israeli receives 300 liters of water per day, while a Palestinian receives a much smaller share of 73 liters. The problem is accentuated when the water usage of illegal Jewish settlers is taken into account. The average settler consumes as much as 800 liters per day, while entire Palestinian communities could be denied a drop of water for days and weeks, often as a form of collective punishment. The issue with the water is not just that of outright theft, denial of access, or unequal distribution of water resources. It is also that of the lack of clean and safe drinkable water, an issue that has been highlighted by international human rights groups for many years. The result of these unfair policies has forced many Palestinians to purchase water brought by trucks at prices ranging from $4 to $10 per cubic meter. Amnesty International found, highlighting that for the poorest Palestinian communities, water expenses can at times make up half of a family's monthly income. As bad as the situation may sound, the plight of besieged Gaza is much worse than that of the occupied West Bank. The tiny and overcrowded strip is the perfect example of the Zionist regime cruelty. 2 million Palestinians live there while being denied the most basic human rights, let alone freedom of movement. Since the Zionist regime military blockade on Gaza in 2007, the environment of coastal region has been in constant deterioration. With little electricity and with bombed-out sewage plants, Palestinians have been forced to dump their unprocessed sewage into the Gaza. Gaza's underground water is now polluted to the extent that 97% of the available water is now undrinkable, according to the United Nations report. This is only the tip of the iceberg. From the destruction of Palestinian wells, to the poisoning of trees, to the demolishing of entire ecosystems to make space for the Zionist regime's apartheid wall, to the use of depleted uranium in its various wars against Gaza, the Zionist regime has been on an unrelenting mission to ruin Palestine's environment in all of its manifestations. Those who are hurting the planet have no right to claim the role of being its survivors. The Zionist regime, in its current violent regime, is the enemy of the environment, and this is what it truly should be known for.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States has decided to bolster its military ties to NATO ally Greece. The military agreement was concluded during the recent visit of the Greek Minister of Foreign Affairs, Nikos Dendias, to Washington. The new agreement will remain in force indefinitely unless one of the parties withdraws. The military agreement will make Greece the U.S. military logistics center in the region.
Greece has been in America's orbit and has enjoyed a strategic partnership with America ever since the end of the Greek Civil War, in which the Greek nationalists triumphed over the Greek communists as a result of the military assistance which America provided to them.
The U.S. will also have increased military presence in the Alexandroupolis, Crete, the Tochoro, and Larissa regions. The renewed agreement gives the U.S. the right to access any Greek military bases and to expand the areas for the U.S. forces to conduct military drills. The U.S. Navy will also be able to go to Bulgaria and Romania without using Turkey's straits. the agreement will significantly reduce the importance of Turkey regarding Black Sea access. Greece has been trying to position itself strategically in the region.
The Americans are encountering some problems with Erdogan. So by America and Greece concluding this extraordinary military deal, it is a way of the Americans placing subtle pressure on Erdogan, not on the Turkish state, but on Erdogan personally.
In recent months, the U.S. has sent heavy military equipment to the Balkans and European countries through the port of Alexandroupolis, with plans for further military shipments in November. Back in November 2020, Greece submitted a request to the U.S. Department of Defense to purchase F-35 fighter jets. The proposal was welcomed by the U.S. In other words, it would not be surprising if the F-35s, which were not given to Turkey, were given to the neighboring country soon. The military cooperation between the U.S. and Greece comes amid a row between Ankara and Athens. Greece and Turkey are both NATO members, but they are at loggerheads over a number of issues. Back in 2020, Turkey dispatched Oryx Reis and warships escorting it to survey an area between Cyprus and the Greek island of Crete in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. The mission was meant to explore oil and natural gas in that region. That led to an escalation of tensions, with the two NATO allies launching air and naval drills of their own in the waters.
The major reason behind this agreement, this military agreement between Washington and Athens, is a result of America having gathered some of its allies from the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Middle East in an Eastern Mediterranean partnership. Now, what am I referring to? Well, I'm referring to the reserves of oil and gas which have been found adjacent to Cyprus.
Greece has also accused Turkey of acting like a pirate state in the Aegean Sea in regards to migrants. Athens has called on the EU to put pressure on Ankara to meet its international obligations. Athens frequently blames Ankara for failing to crack down on smugglers who send out migrants in unsafe boats from its shores in breach of a 2016 accord with the European Union. Under the accord, Turkey was to reduce the flow of migrants through its territory to EU countries such as Greece, return for billions in financial aid.
Well, of course, Turkey is a dangerously expansionist country. After all, Turkey illegally occupies the north of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies the northwest of Syria. However, there is very little chance of a conflict between Turkey and Greece. Why? Because both countries are in NATO and both countries enjoy a strategic partnership with America.
It is believed Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is using the migrant issue to put more pressure on the European Union. The military cooperation between Greece and the U.S. would give Athens a greater leverage in its confrontation with Turkey. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has not made it a secret in the aspirations that it has to have influence in the entire West Asia region and beyond.
World temperatures are rising fast, and that is mostly because humans are using fossil fuels like oil, gas, and coal for their transportation, industries, and homes. The use of these fuels releases a great amount of greenhouse gases, mostly carbon dioxide, which trap the sun's heat and make the earth warmer. That is global warming. This phenomenon is leading to long-term shifts in temperatures and weather patterns, which is known as climate change. The dangerous trend is causing extreme weather conditions. The impact is being felt in many parts of the world, but the worst could be yet to come. Combating climate change requires concrete measures by the international community, especially the world's largest polluters like the United States and China. But scientists have repeatedly warned that global efforts to tackle climate change are way off track. Global warming and climate change have been under the spotlight in the Scottish city of Glasgow over the past 2 weeks as delegations from around the world attended the UN Climate Change Conference. Participants tried hard to find a way forward to contain what many scientists have called the biggest crisis of humanity. The world's largest industrial nations long struggled to find common ground, but an unexpected declaration by the United States and China this week raised hopes for a breakthrough.
Certain elements that will promote ambition.
The United States and China have pledged to work together to achieve the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal set out in 2015. China's climate envoy says the two sides hammered out the declaration following some 30 meetings over the past year. U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping are expected to hold a follow-up meeting soon. The announcement was welcomed by the United Nations and the European Union. But global campaigning network Greenpeace says both countries need to take concrete action. Some experts have noted that this week's declaration was short on commitments that would significantly reduce the emissions of harmful gases like CO2.
Everyone is being very careful not to say anything definitive. There are few dates, few specific levels things will get to, and few amounts of money that will go to developing countries. So there's pretty much nothing that doesn't need to be more specific. You know, we're all good guys and we're going to cooperate and make this work. Well, we've heard that before.
Scientists warn that the world faces a race against time. Climate Action Tracker Group has calculated that the world is facing 2.4 degrees of warming by the end of the 21st century. If the world fails to act, scientists estimate that it could even exceed 4 degrees in the future. That will probably lead to destructive heat waves, with many millions of people around the world losing their homes as sea levels rise. Temperature rises must be contained quickly if the international community is determined to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. That means global warming needs to be kept at 1.5 degrees Celsius in the coming decades. That seems like a far-fetched wish, given the record of the worst polluters.
I'm not feeling overly optimistic. I'm not really feeling optimistic at all, because it seems like this is just more grandstanding by the particularly China and the United States and even the European Union, who have gotten things. The developing countries have gotten things to this point.
All eyes are now on the world's largest emitters to see how they will act.
The United States Federal Bureau of Investigation is taken to court over a lawsuit by three Muslim men that alleges the agency illegally conducted surveillance on them on the basis of their religion. Sheikh Yasir Fazaga, Ali Malik, and Yasser Abdulrahim, the three plaintiffs in the case, argue that the U.S. government has for years invoked national security to escape accountability over its unconstitutional surveillance operations and deny them the chance to present their evidence to the court. Initially filed in 2011, their case was first dismissed by a lower court in favor of the FBI's assertion that allowing it to move forward would pose a national security risk. The trio appealed the ruling, and a federal appeals court later sided with them, paving the way for the case to land in the High Court. The FBI recruited a paid informant to spy on the mosque and other places of worship in the area beginning in 2006. The informant, identified as Craig Monte, had presented himself as a person who wanted to convert to Islam.
They've always tried to label Muslims as potential terrorists and investigate them, monitor them, looking in, all their most of their privacy has been breached. All these mosques, as we can read and study about, is pretty much, it's open to the FBI to, send in informants, spies, making feel very uncomfortable, and also a lot of them are saying that they feel like second-class citizens or third-class citizens inside their own country.
Pazaga, the lead plaintiff in the case who is also a therapist, said he was furious when he found out that the FBI informant secretly recorded the personal and confidential sessions he had with his patients for a month. The surveillance operation in Southern California was part of a broader spying program that the U.S. government enforced after 9/11, using various tactics to monitor Muslim communities in the name of national security.
This is a systematic problem in the U.S., and they wanted it to be this way. It's been programmed like this by the U.S. It's because they want to install fear in American citizens everywhere, so they can also justify invasions to Muslim countries and to, invade different Muslim countries.
The Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling on the Muslims case by the end of June. Lawyers for the government will argue that the case should be dismissed, as letting it proceed would expose clandestine intelligence operations and harm national security. The FBI has long contended that the information about its informants, methods of surveillance, and who they are monitoring and why should be treated as state secrets. Human rights activists, however, say citing national security concerns is an excuse to avoid admitting that they target people based on their religion. The plaintiffs argue that under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, a judge can review the material and order that it be disclosed. They contend that in a case like theirs, the 1978 law supersedes the state secrets privilege, which was adopted by the Supreme Court in the 1950s. Government lawyers' counter-argument is that FISA was not meant for a case where the government certifies that the disclosure would jeopardize national security. All eyes are on the Supreme Court justices, whose ruling will indicate whether they are willing to protect religious freedoms or if the government has the authority to cover up its illegal activities in the name of national security.
The Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian senior officials and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the MKO. Yet, the West, which claims to be against terrorism, supports this terrorist group officially. Despite all the crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US removed the widely detested terrorist group from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012, respectively. West even misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor by putting a blind eye to how the MKO spilled the blood of innocent people. On November 4th, the ringleader of MKO, Mayem Rajavi, delivered an online address to an Italian Senate panel on the situation of human rights in Iran. 2 days later, the Secretary of Human Rights Headquarters of the Iranian Judiciary, Kazem Gharibabadi, condemned the session. He slammed Western countries for adopting a selective approach to human rights by allowing the anti-Iran Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization to hold, quote, ridiculous meetings on the issue in the host countries. He also called on the Italian government to end their dual and destructive policies towards terrorism and human rights. Iran has long complained that the West's backing for terrorist organizations like MKO violates the UN Charter and international principles. The West accuses Iran of human rights violations, yet their double standard policies towards terrorism speak for themselves. Also, in July at a sideline meeting at the 47th session of the United Nations Human Rights Council, diplomats, scholars, and representatives from NGOs criticized Western countries for their hypocrisy on human rights and using it as a geopolitical tool to attack countries that do not serve their interests.
But, you know, groups like MKO have been legitimized as not a terrorist group any longer because it serves a purpose. is giving Western nations a sort of what they want, creating acts of terrorism in Iran, and indeed assassination of scientists.
The U.S. itself has been long accused of violating human rights. Their violations have been blatant when it comes to racial discrimination, especially against the African-American community. The case of George Floyd, an African-American man who was murdered by a police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, is one example of many. Hezbollah in Lebanon, popular mobilization forces in Iraq, and Ansarullah movement in Yemen are against the interests and policies of the West. Therefore, they are designated as terrorist organizations by Western countries. That's why these extremes have fought hard and are the true defenders of the rights of their countries and regional nations. Meanwhile, MKO terrorists enjoy the freedom of activity in the US and Europe, and even hold regular meetings in which European and American officials make speeches. West's support for such a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations. And let's not forget the Western countries, namely the US, support for one of the biggest violators of human rights, the Israeli regime, an illegitimate regime that has a long list of human rights violations, including the occupation of Palestinian land, illegal settlement activities, inhumane blockade on Palestinians, administrative detentions, and many others.
There needs to be a unity on combating those who commit acts of terrorism internationally, rather than this sort of use of the terrorist group as allies, and then giving them international support and international legitimacy. MKO is a perfect example of this, but unfortunately is not the only one.
The US, Britain, and France are among violators of human rights. They use sanctions to pressure other governments to give in to their demands, while that directly affects the civilian population and causes hardship for them. These countries have not only supported dictatorial regimes like Saudi Arabia, whom they have sold weapons to in a war on Yemen, they have also supported the Israeli regime that violates Palestinian rights. Meanwhile, the West's anti-Iran obsession and shameful support for terrorism smacks of double standards.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
The U.S. occupied Afghanistan for 20 years,
and brought all sorts of oppression against the Afghan people. They bombarded their mourning ceremonies and their weddings. They killed their youth. They imprisoned many individuals without any reason in different prisons, and they increased the production of addictive drugs in Afghanistan by tens of times. They did all of these, but refused to take one step to help develop Afghanistan. In other words, if today's Afghanistan, in terms of civil rights, construction, and other such developments, is not worse than those days, it is not better either. So, the US did nothing. Now that they are leaving, it is in such a disgraceful way. Look at the situation in the Kabul airport, the large crowds, and the problems. They only take those who have cooperated with them over all these years and they wish to take. But there are reports showing that their situation is worse than those who stay. There are numerous problems for them in the centers where they are being kept. This is how the US is.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In any case, we support the nation of Afghanistan. Governments come and go. All sorts of governments held power in Afghanistan over these years. So, governments come and go. It is the people of Afghanistan who are permanently there. We support the nation of Afghanistan. The nature of our relations with the governments depends on the nature of their relations with us. May God bring the best situation for the nation of Afghanistan, liberating them from the situation and putting them in the best of conditions. I hope that He bestows His blessings on them and on us, God willing. I hope that God bestows success on the Iranian nation and eliminates the problems. I pray that you honorable officials of the new administration will succeed in the tasks that you have undertaken and overcome the problems. I hope that you fulfill your promises, help the people with their problems and satisfy the people, God willing. The people's satisfaction will lead to the satisfaction of God, the Exalted as well. Having pure and divine intentions and having the intention to serve will help you. God's mercy be upon our dear martyrs, upon our magnanimous Imam, and upon all those who worked for the sake of God and on the path of the truth. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world.
world with reporters.
Palestinian factions in the blockaded Gaza Strip protested in front of the UNRWA office against aid cuts and demanded the agency scrap the so-called framework agreement with the United States. The framework agreement signed last July is a two-year working plan between the U.S. State Department and UNRWA. The protest comes less than a week ahead of the International Conference on UNRWA that will be held in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden. The Hamas movement said the agreement exposes Palestinian refugees to grave dangers.
We call on donor countries to provide UNRWA with all necessary funding and alleviate the suffering of millions of Palestinian refugees. We also maintain that the framework agreement will place UNRWA under the U.S. hegemony and undermine the Palestinian refugees' right of return to the land of their ancestors.
The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Al-Quds, the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Settler colonialist regimes that helped Zionist gangs occupy Palestine and displace its people in 1948 must stop helping the Israeli regime. Upon the creation of the illegitimate Zionist entity, those gangs destroyed over 500 Palestinian towns and villages and committed dozens of massacres against the indigenous Palestinian population.
UNRWA has long been a priority target for the Israeli regime and its allies. Over the past decades, the Israeli regime had been campaigning to defund UNRWA and end its mandate.
The so-called framework agreements between the United States and UNRWA aims to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees. Palestinians across the political spectrum denounced the agreement. The U.S. wants to turn the UNRWA into a security agency in the occupied territories.
Experts say the so-called framework agreement with UNRWA is an attempt by the United States to delegitimize and depoliticize the issue of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA is the UN agency responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinian refugees in West Asia who were displaced and dispossessed upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment, and custodial torture continue with impunity while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Major problem in Pakistan.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over seven decades. Both countries claim the region in full, but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
This
Islamic Jihad movement held a massive festival in the Gaza Strip marking the second anniversary of the assassination of Baha Abul Atta, Islamic Jihad commander, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes on his house. Targeting Abul Atta triggered a tough round of violence between Palestinians and the Israeli regime.
We are here to express our support to the resistance front that has never failed to defend us. Palestinians in Gaza are living in a continuous struggle, but this makes us more determined to defend our rights.
Baha Abul Atta was the head of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad. Baha was one of the most prominent members of its military wing and played a major role in carrying out operations against Israel.
We will remain steadfast and committed to our oath to our leader, Baha Abul Atta. Losing our commanders won't undermine our resistance. We will resist and won't be hesitant to defend our people and the Palestinian cause.
Palestinians in this event also stressed following in the footsteps of Abul Atta in the battle against the Israeli occupation, vowing to keep their resistance until their rights are restored.
Our message to the Israeli regime is that if you assassinate a leader, there will be thousands of other leaders to continue the path of resistance. The killing of Palestinian leaders won't undermine our will to keep up our fight against Israel.
Palestinians here say that the killing of the leaders won't stop the battle against the Zionists. They also vow to remain committed to their resistance as their only means to defend their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
New Delhi hosted a third regional summit to discuss the ongoing situation in neighboring Afghanistan following the recent pullout of U.S. and NATO forces from the country. The conference was chaired by India's National Security Advisor Ajit Doval and his counterparts from other Central Asian nations. India's National Security Advisor opened the dialogue.
We all have been keenly watching the developments in that country. These have important implications not only for the people of Afghanistan but also for its neighbors and the region. This is the time for close consultations amongst us, greater cooperation and interaction and coordination among the regional countries.
Top security officials reiterated pledge to work for ensuring safe Afghanistan and what they called free of safe haven for global terrorism. The delegates also called for formation of inclusive government in Kabul, stressing the territory should not be used for sheltering, training, planning or financing terror activities.
This could perhaps be the first time Central Asian countries are coming together on a single platform to not only discuss their role in rebuilding war-ravaged Afghanistan, but also formulate a collective strategies which could promote peace, stability and security in the region.
Issues related to radicalization, extremism, separatism and drug trafficking in the region were also discussed in the meeting. The officials expressed deep concern about the sufferings Afghan people have endured before and after the U.S. fallout. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, stressed on rebuilding inclusive Afghanistan, saying U.S. policies brought nothing but miseries and devastation in the region.
Afghanistan's neighbors need to fulfill its duties to settle the crisis unfolding in the country, including efforts to hold to account the countries behind the current situation there, establish an inclusive government comprised of all ethnicities there, and tackle the humanitarian crisis gripping the war-torn country. The Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to rebuild Afghanistan. Regional partners should also exert pressure on the United States to unblock the financial resources of the oppressed nation.
Security chiefs from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan also attended the talks. However, neighboring China and Pakistan did not attend the forum, citing scheduling reasons. The first two editions of the event were held in Iran in September 2018 and December 2019. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Leaving amid shouts of shame, Israel's